Get job ready today at Shasta College. Whether you're interested in accounting or agriculture, automotive or nursing, or any of our many other career trainings, our in-demand programs will give you the skills you need for a fulfilling and exciting future career. Planning to transfer? Start here and complete your first 2 years. Then transfer to a CSU or UC with guaranteed placement. And the best part is, all full-time students get 2 years tuition for free. Choose the class format that works for you. In-person, online, hybrid, or 8-week accelerated courses designed for busy adults. You may even qualify for up to $4,000 per semester through our 15 to finish program. Restrictions apply. See a counselor for details. Fall semester begins August 18th, so don't wait. Enroll today at ShastaCollege.edu or call 530-242-7650. Your success starts at Shasta College.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
From all the fine art mediums that there are, photography has a claim to authenticity that other art mediums don't necessarily share. And I think photography has been particularly important to shaping even perceptions about historical events and social movements in America.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Dr. Christina Lam Chikalova, Assistant Professor of Art here at Hillsdale College. She returns this week for another deeper conversation into the history of American art. More on that later on in the show. First, we're joined by Adam Kissel. He's Visiting Fellow for Higher Education Reform in the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation, also the co-author of the new book, Slacking, A Guide to Ivy League Miseducation. Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
You recognize your co-authors on the book, Rachel Alexander Comber and also Madison Marino Doan. So three authors for this Slacking book that is now out. People see what's happening on college campuses these days, TV, and perhaps ask themselves, what the heck is going on there? And Slacking tries to at least in part answer that question. What the heck is happening on our college campuses, specifically our Ivy League schools?
Well, the moral and cultural rot that people perceive has a lot of its roots in the failure of the curriculum. The general education core curriculum across the Ivy League, with the one exception of Columbia University, uses a ways of knowing approach or a distribution requirements approach rather than having any content at its moral center or its academic center. What that means is that there's a Emersonian romantic view of what you're supposed to do in college, which is to pursue your dreams and your own values and have your own self-indulgent ideas take you where your education should go. In contrast to a classical conception of personhood and morality and core knowledge based on an articulation of what an educated person, especially an educated American as part of Western civilization, should know, not just be able to do, but also specifically know in order to function well in the world. On the one hand, if you take a romantic view and any history class that you feel like taking counts for any other, you have a feeling and worldview on campus that there is no knowledge worth having or most worth having in general for a human being or a citizen. And that influences the morality and the culture of the entire place.
The phrase core curriculum is used throughout Slacking, and you allude to it there in that first answer. For people who aren't familiar, we are familiar here at Hillsdale with the core curriculum or a core curriculum. What is it? Why is it so important to a well-rounded and a good education?
There's a famous line by Matthew Arnold, at this point more than 100 years ago, referring to the best that has been thought and said in the world. There's a certain amount of cultural heritage that has been passed on from previous generations to us that is not a particular doctrine that everyone must believe, but talk about it in terms of a great conversation. A great book out of the Western tradition addresses core issues for any human being and a citizen of any polity. And when you engage those fundamental questions at the origin of all learned inquiry, as the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago puts it, then you're part of a multi-generational investigation of the best that has been thought and said and might be thought and said. So a core curriculum engages you with the great texts that have engaged the hardest questions of identity and citizenship, role of government, religion, what to do with your life every day, how to handle relationships with other people. And it's a moral formation as much as an intellectual formation. That's at the core. And then you can go ahead and take some electives and you can specialize in a particular topic. But the core is what every educated person should have experienced.
Something that we talk about, too, is the fact that when students do take the same classes, read the same books, there exists a sense of community and, by extension, a sense of civility among the student body that perhaps does not when everyone is taking different courses, learning different things, reading different things. Is that a side benefit of also a core curriculum, the fact that perhaps there's a bit more civility among students and perhaps as they go out into the world?
I wonder if it's not a side benefit, but part of the core of having that shared experience. When you engage in the world with someone else who's well-educated and you refer to something out of the Bible or American history or more broadly Western civilization, some of the great texts, and that other person understands you and understands the reference, you've connected with them in an important personal way. Then being able to say, to take the next step, and say, so what about that Achilles versus Agamemnon problem at the beginning of the Iliad? And someone says, yeah, there really is a problem with trying to stand up for yourself against government authority. You can get to that next step of a civil debate because you have, in rhetorical terms, what's called a topos, a common place to start from to have a conversation. If you don't have a common place to start from, then you're in a lot more trouble. It's important to a core to have that ground for a civil conversation.
Adam Kissel with us. His book, Slacking, A Guide to Ivy League Miseducation. Adam, how long have these Ivy League schools, or at least most of them, had this distributional approach to education? When did they slide away from having a core curriculum?
Each university has its own story, but I would say a few things. One is through most of the history of classical education and higher education in general through the time of Ralph Waldo Emerson, so we're talking about the mid-19th century, there was a core set of information that was expected in higher learning. Emerson comes along, says, hitch your wagon to a star, the romantic style of education starts to take hold at places like Harvard, where electives enter the scene. So instead of everything being set out for you, you can choose your own adventure. That took a different form at different institutions, and it had already become such a new way of thinking that already by the 1930s, there was a general education movement to return to this idea of a general education that was suitable for all people getting a college education. The second stream that was hopefully addressed by the general education movement was the German university research model, in which people would specialize, do critical analysis at a deep level of engagement, and lose that generalist approach. It was a graduate student versus undergraduate approach, to put it in simple terms. So the general education movement was the answer to both of those trends. And then in the early 20th century, meanwhile, somehow at Columbia University, it was decided there should be a core, and somehow that core of Western civilization has persisted to this day. So Columbia has its own story. At some point in the mid-20th century, I don't remember the full story of Brown University, the open curriculum happened. The idea was it should be all electives. Choose the whole adventure for yourself. You can still have a major, but there's no core, maybe just some writing classes. So Brown also has its own story to tell separately from the rest of the Ivies.
We're talking with Adam Kissel. He's the co-author of Slacking, A Guide to Ivy League Miseducation. More details on specific Ivy League schools in just a moment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Ready to turn your dreams into reality? At Simpson University, we offer a private Christian education that enriches your academic journey with faith and purpose. Whether you're pursuing your undergraduate degree, completing your degree, or advancing through graduate studies, our dynamic programs, personalized mentorship, and vibrant community are here to support you. Discover how Simpson University can help you achieve your goals and grow spiritually. Visit simpsonu.edu today to learn more. Simpson University, where your potential is limitless.
The Ramsey Show.
You actually can help people, and you don't help them by giving them a government program. You help them by showing them the way out. People love me enough to put their arm around me and show me a different way. I didn't figure it all out in my own head. So there's a power to hope, but that's not some kind of false panacea positive thinking way. It works. You can't positive think your way into everything, but you can't negative think your way into anything.
Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
At the Community Foundation of the North State, we believe strong communities start with generosity and connection. As a grant-making public charity for over 25 years, we link people who care with causes that matter, supporting education, the arts, health, and more across the North State. Together, we're creating a lasting impact right here at home. The Community Foundation of the North State. Local giving, powerful results. Visit cfnorthstate.org to learn more. A proud sponsor of the Reading Colt 45s.
This season, Hunter Roofing is stepping up to the plate. As proud sponsors of Colt 45's baseball, we're cheering on every home run and keeping your home protected. From storm repairs to full replacements, trust the pros who bring quality to every job. Hunter Roofing, where quality meets the sky. Support local, keep your home in winning shape, and root for the Colt 45s. Visit hunterroofing.org today.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa and Janet Chandler. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archive link.
Come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson State of Mind.
Looking for work? O2 Employment Services has been working with local job seekers for the past 20 years. If you're tired of uploading your resume and getting no response, it's time to let O2 help you find that perfect position. Oh, and by the way, you pay absolutely nothing for our service. If you'd like our help, head on over to our website at o2es.com, click apply now, and complete our online application. We have connections with over 600 local businesses. Once we have your information and understand what you're looking for, we can introduce you to all the positions you may wish to consider. We currently have over 100 available positions, and we would love to match you with the one you're looking for. O2 Employment Services, the North State's leading staffing agency. Give us a call at 530-223-4674. That's 530-223-4674. Or visit us online at o2es.com.
Join me, Mark Levin, weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. KCNR, your talk radio.
Donald Trump is doing something that's never been done in American history. Now, what Trump is trying to do all at once, he wants to, what I call, reindustrialize America.
Mark Levin is on the radio.
KCNR, your talk radio.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram, talking with Adam Kissel, visiting fellow for higher education reform in the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation and co-author of the recent book, Slacking, A Guide to Ivy League Miseducation. In Slacking, Adam, each chapter covers a different Ivy League institution. Two outliers at the end we'll talk about in a minute, but these other institutions, almost all of them you look and you see there are, at Yale, for example, 298 courses to fulfill a writing requirement, and there are other schools where there are 300 courses to fulfill X requirement. How do you get to a point where a school says, yes, you can take any one of these 300 options, and we'll deem you knowledgeable about that subject?
Well, the real answer is that they don't deem you knowledgeable about that subject. The history classes, for instance, using a ways of knowing approach, teach you to think like a historian. The history that you know is irrelevant so long as you know how to think like a historian, use some historical methods. The same is true in literatures, to think like a literary critic and theorist, not necessarily to know any particular literature. So this ways of knowing approach is what powers the distribution requirements. Some of this, some of that, a little science, a little arts, a little humanities. And that's in the interest of the faculty, because not only do they not have to articulate what a person should know to be educated, but also, any department can get a piece of it. Mm-hmm. There could be a history of music class to teach your history, for instance. Every department wants to get some people in seats and get some core curriculum students. They get maybe some tuition money kicked back out of that. So they're happy to have distribution requirements.
Slacking's the book. Adam Kissel, the co-author. There's a long-standing joke about these classes and majors that athletes take in colleges, you know, basket weaving, things like that. At Princeton, an Ivy League institution, you point out in Slacking that someone could, if he or she wanted, take care of some of these requirements by taking classes such as shoes and a perfect cup of coffee. And it's not just Princeton. There are ridiculous classes at all of these institutions. Anything else jump out to you as some of your favorite non-serious courses?
There's a lot of them. At Harvard, you can take, to meet your arts and humanities requirement, a course called Zombies, Witchcraft, and Uncanny Science. There's a lot of courses that are self-indulgent, tendentious, question-begging, very biased. Staying at Harvard, there's Legitimacy and Resistance in an Unjust World. Hashtag Abolish Police, The Politics of Public Safety in the Age of Social Media, Queer Coming of Age Stories. Also, not say turning to Yale, there's a course called Pop Sapphism. There's a number of courses in pop culture, which you'd think that students of a certain age already know pretty well. Mm-hmm. Comparative Settler Geographies. A couple of my favorites are at Penn, Decolonizing French Food. So these go on, and we could spend a lot more time just naming the titles of courses. But if you read the course descriptions, you also can be as appalled or entertained as you like, from climate change to, again, so I don't know what to say about. Well, we should talk about the other side of the story, too. So it's not all bad. A generation ago, the question was, is it still required that you take Western Civ, U.S. history, and Shakespeare? But now, in our generation, the question is there even one class at an Ivy League university in those areas that's worth taking? And the answer often is yes, there's one, maybe two. So you can still get your course on Beowulf once in a while, or your course on Shakespeare. It may even be a good one.
Yeah.
May even be taught well. There's a lot to make fun of, but there's still a few remnant courses.
And that's a point that you make in Slacking, which is at the conclusion of many of these chapters, you present two options. One, if someone wanted to kind of slide by and not challenge oneself. And a second option for more serious classes at each of these institutions. You do say, too, there are two outliers, and I wanted to talk briefly about both of them in the Ivy League, Brown and Columbia. Let's start with Brown first. So Brown has, you mentioned this previously, a different way, an open curriculum rather than general education requirements. What does that mean for students at Brown?
So at Brown, you still have to take enough credits to get a degree. So it's not an entire free-for-all where they pretend to teach, you pretend to learn, and at the end you get a degree. You still have to take at least 30 courses. There's 80 concentrations to choose from. You have to be in residence at least half the time, so 4 out of 8 semesters. And there's a writing requirement. Other than that, you're on your own to decide what you should study. That's what an open curriculum is. So in the book, we only look at the writing requirement because it is a requirement. And just like we said before, you could take Sex, Power, and God, a medieval perspective. You could take the racial politics of national culture, a course called How Can Activists Change the World? The Dynamics of Power and Resistance. There's some more interesting ones. You could take Shakespeare. You could take a course that includes Homer, Plato, Marco Polo, and et cetera. And then finally, about Brown, there is a first-year seminar that's optional. Race, Power, and Privilege is optional. There's about 80 choices for that. Same thing, right? So Queer Asias could be the course you take for Race, Power, and Privilege in that subject area. And then you could take Friendship in the Ancient World, probably a very respectable course. Mm-hmm. So the choices are be a slacker, and there's a million ways to be a slacker, or be a striver and follow the narrow path.
The other school that's the outlier, Adam, is Columbia. And one of the most stark statements in the book is there is no room for slackers at Columbia. They still have a core curriculum. I think a question people would ask knowing that, but also seeing what's been happening, is how do you square that there is no room for slackers at Columbia with the protests, the anti-Semitism, all the goings-on that's happening on Columbia's campus these days?
It's a great question. There's fewer than 5,000 undergraduates on Columbia's campus. I was surprised when I learned that the total enrollment at Columbia is more like 36,000. So there's 30,000 graduate students on campus, half of them Chinese, half of them from other countries. So when you look at what is going on, I would guess that the agitators are mainly not just outsiders from Columbia, but mainly graduate students from other countries. The undergrads have core courses to take. The undergraduate body is just a small part. One of the jokes about Harvard is that Harvard University is really a hedge fund with a small undergraduate college attached. And so Columbia has some of that same characteristic, where it's a graduate institution of the world with a small undergraduate body.
Adam Kissel is visiting fellow for higher education reform in the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation, also co-author along with Rachel Alexander Comber and Madison Marino Doan of the new book, Slacking, A Guide to Ivy League Miseducation. Adam, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Scott, thanks so much for having me.
Up next, Dr. Christina Lamb Chikalova is back with us to talk more about the history of American art. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This is Carl Bott. Join me on Tuesday as I welcome Turtle Bay with an update on Glowing Wild. Also joining us is Shasta Regional Medical Center with the latest on the new technology and the new procedures available at Shasta Regional Medical Center. All of this Tuesday right here, Free Fire Radio, KCNR, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio. Miss a day, miss a lot.
Have you ever wanted to unlock your musical potential? Cascade Curations not only has great music, art, and fashion, we also offer fun and exciting music lessons for all ages and skill levels. Whether you dream of playing the piano, guitar, drums, or vocals, our instructors will guide you every step of the way. With flexible scheduling and personalized instruction, you'll be playing your own tunes in no time. Don't just listen to music, create it. Call or text us at 530-255-4855 to book your first lesson. Cascade Curations, where we believe anyone can learn to play their own song.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Arturo Fuente Chateau Maduro, handmade in the Dominican Republic with a dark Connecticut broadleaf wrapper, giving us a rich, medium-bodied cigar with pleasant notes of coffee, vanilla, and sweet spiciness. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
This is Colonel Danny Gillum, the host of Frontlines of Freedom, the nation's largest military news and talk radio show. We address the most pressing issues facing the security of our nation, our armed forces, our veterans, and their families. Please join us every Saturday morning from 6 to 8 on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM KCNR, your talk radio show.
Travel is here, and it can be tough on a vehicle. Whether it's dust or dirt, pollution or road grime, stop by Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading. They offer car wash packages starting at $11. Quick and Clean's gentle, automated pull-through wash includes a hand scrub pre-clean and a personal towel dry exit. Save money, save water at Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. You can find our shows wherever you get your audio, but you can find them all at podcast.hillsdale.edu. Older episodes of this program, plus episodes of The Larry Arnn Show, Imprimis, The Hillsdale Dialogues, and the Hillsdale College Online Courses Podcast. Take our online courses in audio form at the Hillsdale College Podcast Network, podcast.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Christina Lamb-Chikalova. She is Assistant Professor of Art at Hillsdale College. Dr. Chikalova, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We continue our conversation on the history of American art. How do we define American art? You spent time in the fall teaching an entire course on this question, so you're an expert. We deem you. How has American art been shaped by historical events, by social movements throughout our nation's history?
So this was a really good question, and thought about it quite a bit, and I decided that I'm going to answer this question through one artistic medium, and that is going to be through the medium of photography, because from all the fine art mediums that there are, photography has a claim to authenticity that other art mediums don't necessarily share. And I think photography has been particularly important to shaping even perceptions about historical events and social movements in America. So one good example to start with here is the photographic sketchbook that was published by Alexander Gardner, but with the assistance of an army of photographers like Timothy O'Sullivan, who did a very famous picture called The Harvest of Death. This was taken at Gettysburg in 1863, you know, right after the battle had ended. I believe they showed up around like July 5th, so a lot of the bodies had not been interred yet, and one of the photographers here took his camera right onto the field. He put his camera very low to the ground and basically took a photograph on site of a lot of bodies of Union soldiers. Their shoes had been taken off. Their pockets had been strewn through. A lot of them were already bloated in death. And he took this picture that greatly drew attention to the calamity of the Civil War. You know, until now, when art has engaged with war, usually it's a painting, and it's a very heroic painting that paints war in this light of like pageantry. You know, it's heroic. It's wonderful. It's the greatest civil act that you could do. Well, maybe, yes, this is true. But when you have a photograph of the war and a photograph of dead bodies, which is something we're very used to today, we live in a world saturated with images and violence, and all of this is quite normal. You know, just open up your app on the news and you'll see images like this on a daily basis. But that wasn't true for the 1860s in the United States. And so here we have an example of a photographer who is drawing attention to the war, but not necessarily highlighting the heroic aspects of it, but just the raw reality of war and death and essentially the consequences of war, especially when brothers are fighting brothers. You know, nobody's really a winner. And of course, the Battle of Gettysburg is the bloodiest battle in the history of U.S. history. So this was an interesting time when photography is now being used as a way to kind of draw attention to the severity of what is at hand.
Dr. Chikolova, this is really the beginning of what we call documentary photography. Who and what comes next for that aspect of American art?
That made me think, too, about Jacob Riis, who went into the tenements of New York City to use his camera as an instrument for social justice. And, of course, interesting about Jacob Riis is that he also figured out how to use, like, magnesium powder to make a flash of the camera. And so for the first times, he's kind of going into the deepest, darkest, dingiest places in New York City and kind of bringing to light what the plight is of America's immigrants. And so here too, another time where American art photography is kind of shaping perception about what is happening in our country at that time. And of course, also to, in essence, affect change. Dorothy Lange did a very similar thing during the period of the Great Depression. She was tasked to go out to California and kind of photograph a lot of migrant workers who had, for the most part, kind of fled the central part of the United States. There was the Dust Bowl, you know, all of that was going on. People were moving to California in search of work, and what they found was no possible living conditions, terrible working conditions. And so with her camera, Dorothy Lange kind of brought attention to the plight of these people. Famously, she has a picture of Florence Owens Thompson, a woman with her hand at her mouth and a child over her shoulder. You know, it was a very famous portrait that was then actually printed in the newspaper, widely circulated, and kind of brought attention to what was happening in the U.S. at this time of the Great Depression. Certainly helped to garner support for the New Deal at that time. Perhaps less dramatic is Ansel Adams' use of the camera. Well, it just depends on how you feel about the American landscape. But at the time, Ansel Adams was photographing, you know, it's coming off of the end of the height of the Industrial Revolution. And so he used his camera to draw attention to, like, the beauty of the American landscape and help to further the efforts of the National Parks Movement. Or Edward Curtis, around the same time, was photographing Native Americans and a dying way of life. And so I think when it comes to American art forms, the camera photography has been one of the most important mediums in shaping perceptions about historical events and affecting social movements as well.
Is there anything in particular we should say about the role of art in expressing and responding to the civil rights movement of the 20th century?
Yes. I feel like there are so many examples in this particular case, but when it comes to the civil rights movement, I think one person who's not really political in his art, but when he was, made some serious impacts, that would be Norman Rockwell.
Mm-hmm.
So he rarely did politicizing art, but if he did, it was pretty powerful. Like during, you know, just to go back in time a little bit, like during World War II, he did his four freedoms, freedom from want, speech, worship, and fear. These were really powerful images that were in the Saturday Evening Post. And besides that, he didn't do anything too political, except for when he got a new job at Look magazine, they were putting out an issue in 1964 titled How We Live. They had somebody write an article, and they asked him to, in essence, come up with an image that fits with this theme of the issue, How We Live. And what he came up with was his famous The Problem We All Live With, which is a depiction of Ruby Bridges on her way into her very first day of first grade at a school in New Orleans called William France Elementary School. So in this very powerful composition, what Rockwell does is he puts Ruby essentially in the center of the composition. In front of her are two federal agents. Behind her are two federal agents, which is all based on fact. This is how she literally walked into the school. But the way he frames everybody in the composition is that the only full figure is Ruby herself. The agents are kind of cut off at the shoulder. They are symbolically there. Behind Ruby is terrible graffiti on the wall, tomatoes that have been thrown up against the wall at her. And it's a really, really powerful image that through compositional choices highlights the kind of ideological absurdity of segregation at the time. This is just an adorable little girl dressed beautifully on her first day of first grade. It made me think about on social media today, you know, everyone posts their kids' first day of first grade picture, teacher name, favorite color, you know, all of these things. That was a very different experience for Ruby Bridges. And that's exactly what Norman Rockwell highlights in this painting that is just drawing attention to that absurdity of racial barriers at the time, which thankfully have been broken, and the absurdity of segregation in essence. Yeah. So very powerful work of art that highlights those themes without being in your face. It's really through his compositional choices.
Talking with Christina Lam Chikolova. She'll return in a moment. We'll talk more about the history of American art. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Miss Memory Lane's Timeless Treasures parking lot sale this Saturday. Rock bottom prices in the parking lot and 10, 20, up to 50% off in different areas in the store. Antiques, furniture, military, hunting and fishing, jewelry, home decor, clothing, knives, lamps, and so much more. Saturday the 14th, 9 to 2 at the Shasta Gateway Shopping Center in Anderson. Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage, and Collectibles. You'll love it.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
Helicopter rides, airplane rides, classic cars, aircraft displays. It's all happening this Father's Day. Aviation Day, Sunday, June 15th, from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Benton Airfield in West Reading. Admission is free and parking is free. Sponsored by the Reading EAA. Come for a great breakfast. Put on by the Mount Shasta 99s from 7 a.m. to 11 a.m. Adults are $10. Kids from 5 to 12, $5. Kids under 5 are free. Aviation Day, 2025, Father's Day, Benton Airfield.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning.
My ocean.
So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
This season, Hunter Roofing is stepping up to the plate. As proud sponsors of Colt 45's baseball, we're cheering on every home run and keeping your home protected. From storm repairs to full replacements, trust the pros who bring quality to every job. Hunter Roofing, where quality meets the sky. Support local, keep your home in winning shape, and root for the Colt 45s. Visit hunterroofing.org today.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Don't forget to follow us on X. We're at Hillsdale Radio for updated show and guest information. We continue our conversation with Dr. Christina Lam-Chakalova from our art department about the history of American art. Dr. Chakalova, are there distinct regional styles or themes in American art? Do they help reflect the unique characteristics of different parts of this country?
This is hard to answer, I would say. So yes and no. There are definitely certain art movements that are from different regional areas. You know, the Hudson River School starts out in and around the Hudson River, although I will say they end up going also to the American West. Here, what I really thought about in answering this question is how works of art themselves, perhaps not as a group, but individually, are reflecting unique parts about the American landscape. So I could think of both Native American and more modern American examples of art that do this. For example, the Cliff Palace. So some of us have heard of the Cliff Palace. It was constructed by Puebloans around the Four Corners area of the United States. It's a famous, like, city that's actually built into this kind of wonderful natural overhang there. It is beautiful. It offers fabulous views of the landscape. It's certainly interested in protection from the elements, but it's a very, very clever use of the pre-existing topography to build an architectural setting that is going to, like, benefit the inhabitants. So there are many different examples of Native American art that is really in tune, I think, with unique characteristics of different parts of the country. There are also more kind of modern examples that accomplish the same goal and have the same interests in mind that made me think of, like, Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water in Pennsylvania. Here, too, we're thinking about the natural topography, how to use it to the best of our ability to highlight its beauty, but also to be practical. That was a project that was for someone named Edgar Kaufman Sr. He had a department store in Pittsburgh. He was very wealthy. The idea was to be this kind of retreat from life in the city in Pittsburgh. There was a waterfall there, and what they commissioned him to do was, you know, build a house that has a beautiful view of the waterfall. But Frank Lloyd Wright said, oh no, I'm going to highlight the unique characteristics of this part of the country. I'm going to make the waterfall part of the house. And if you can't actually see the waterfall, you'll hear the waterfall because it's going through the homes. He tried to make all these different kind of alternating floors. What's typical of his architecture is that it constantly oscillates between an interior and an exterior space. If you're in the interior, you can see the exterior. If you're on the exterior, you can transition easily into the interior. And so here, too, an example of architecture that's really interested in highlighting unique characteristics about the setting in which it is placed. And there are many other examples of this as well.
How have American artists helped to contribute to the development of new techniques, new mediums, new styles in the art world?
Well, this takes me back to that point about American art is very ambitious, and I thought about the Gilded Age and the aesthetic movement, which is something that really originated in Britain, responds to the Industrial Revolution and the age of the mass-produced cheap object that fills the role but might not be aesthetically pleasing. And as the Industrial Revolution kind of chugged along, there started to be fewer and fewer artisans who could still really have these outstanding skills and techniques to create beautiful objects that could be at once utilitarian but also works of art. So this made me think about the aesthetic movement in the United States, artisans like Francis Kohler, perhaps more famously like Tiffany, all of these artists working in and around New York, thinking about kind of uniting art with labor once again, uniting the artist and the artisan, thinking about Renaissance jewelry, for example. Francis Kohler looked closely at Renaissance jewelry and thought, hey, in this day of the mass-produced object, you know, maybe some people don't want that mass-produced thing, and I'm going to revive the beautiful and everyday objects that are about quality, but also about utility. At this time, a lot of techniques are at risk of being lost because people don't have time, energy, or resources to fund certain art forms that have been around for hundreds of years. So I think it's really interesting to think about American artists working in and around New York, especially, or Boston East Coast artists at the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, who worked very hard to bring back to life fabulous art forms, which, again, had been around for hundreds of years, with kings and queens commissioning beautiful jewelry and then kind of fell by the wayside. So I think that if they didn't contribute to new techniques, they certainly did. But one of the things that I think is important to highlight is that they helped us not lose endangered art forms, especially when it comes to like jewelry making, glass making, going back to Tiffany or even thinking about John Lafarge, you know, who's commissioning stained glass anymore? It's not the church for beautiful Gothic cathedrals. It's a technology that was at risk of being completely lost. And then you have these ambitious Americans who start to take these ancient art forms and transform them into something new and practical, even for the modern day.
Talking with Dr. Christina Lamb Chikalova about the history of American art. Put you somewhat on the spot here, I guess. If we look back through American art for innovative, groundbreaking artists, great artists, you mentioned a few names through our conversation, but if you're putting together a Mount Rushmore of American artists, who are those that people should seek out and perhaps learn more about to help tell the story of American art?
So that's a really hard question and a loaded question. I think that on the one hand, all American art movements are important and they're all part of the whole. I will take a moment to highlight a little bit more, perhaps, the Hudson River School of Painters. There are many artists here. Some of them are American-born. Some of them were actually trained and born in Germany, like at the Academy in Düsseldorf, and they brought their skills back to the United States, where they have a great audience, very interested in representations of the American landscape. I think that the Hudson River School is so important to highlight, and it's artists like Thomas Cole, Albert Bierstadt, George Innes. There are really so many more. I can hardly name them all. What they did for Americans, especially those who are working in industrial cities around the turn of the century, was to bring glimpses of the beauty of the American landscape into the city and give them an opportunity to interact with something that's beautiful that they know about that they might not actually be able to see themselves. And so today we live in this world saturated by images. We're very used to just Googling something. We all have an impression of what Hawaii looks like because we've all seen a picture of it before.
Right.
In the early 20th century, you don't really have those kinds of opportunities. And what the Hudson River School did was to bring that into the cities. And landscape painting took on a very unique character in the United States that is just not comparable to any other place where landscape painting became popular. I also work in non-Western art. You know, landscape painting in China or Japan has a completely different goal in mind than in the American landscape. So I think the Hudson River School is innovative, groundbreaking, not just for capturing the American landscape, but also for, in a way, preserving it as a way it once looked before the Industrial Revolution. That makes me think of, like, George Ennis, who painted Niagara Falls. And what he ended up doing was taking out all of the modern factories that had been built along the falls to take advantage of kind of the water, the power from the water there. He painted out all of those factories that were around the American landscape, and the Hudson River School helped not only to expand a love for the beauty of the landscape, whether New York and the Catskills, whether it was the West, they also brought attention to Americans that this is at risk of being lost. And I think without the Hudson River School of Painters and their efforts, like, maybe we would never even have the National Parks Movement that we would have had today. So I think their impact is particularly long lasting.
Dr. Christina Lam Chikalova, she is Assistant Professor of Art at Hillsdale College, as we talk about the history of American art and how to define it. Thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Adam Kissel, his new book, Slacking, A Guide to Ivy League Miseducation, and Dr. Christina Lam Chikalova from our art department here at Hillsdale. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
As we all get older, the one constant thing is the aggressive, excessive mail and advertising for Medicare, Medicare supplements, and Medicare Advantage. And almost every one of them is a call center with no idea of what you really need. Siskiyou Insurance has an agent that deals with nothing but Medicare issues and can explain the differences clearly between a Medicare supplement and Medicare Advantage. Call Greg Green at Siskiyou Insurance at 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345.
Cinerama presents Bruise by the Bridge at Turtle Bay in Redding on Saturday, June 21st, 5 p.m. to 9 p.m.
Join us for this unforgettable 21-plus event featuring over 20 craft breweries, live music, games, delicious food, and more.
Next to the Sundial Bridge along the Sacramento River.
With cold beer, great company, and outdoor fun.
All proceeds support Turtle Bay's educational programs and exhibitions.
Don't miss Bruise by the Bridge at Turtle Bay, Saturday, June 21st. Get your tickets now at turtlebay.org.
Now is a great time to prepare for the upcoming wildfire season. REU and city staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our power lines, facilities, and the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home. Clear debris from your roof and gutter and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming and proximity to power lines, call 530-224-4356. Please remember, we all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
If you're tired of artificial intelligence and dishonest news, tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest every other Sunday at 8 a.m.
Join Nick Gardner and Doug Janke, two hosts who were educated at School of Hard Knock. Get a layman's view of local government as well as our take on national and world events.
If you're woke, go back to bed. You won't like us.
This show's for educated voters, not for people that voted for Kamala Harris.
Tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest every other Sunday, 8 a.m. here on KCNR1460.com, 96.5 FM, and 1468.
Do you have something you'd like to get painted? Then bring it to Victory Powder Coating. Powder coating is a durable, colorful, environmentally friendly alternative to paint. It's useful in automotive, agricultural, decorative, and high-temperature applications. Victory Powder Coating has become the North State leader in powder coating applications and metal finishing. They specialize in large industrial items like truck beds, agricultural equipment, and trailers. They're dedicated to providing superior work and outstanding customer care. Consider Victory Powder Coating for your next project. Victory Powder Coating.
Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. ranked best in Reading and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence. You can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
A proud sponsor of the Reading Colt 45s.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.